quick announcement. Linguistics Career Launch 2024 is happening this summer. It will be a two-week event taking place online from July 15th through July 26th, 2024. This is a boot camp that takes linguists in training and in transition from coursework to career through panels, courses, guest speakers, and networking events. Check out our website at linguisticscareerlaunch.com for more information, and then join us July 15th to the 26th, 2024, to access the career management methods you need to research and apply to jobs that use linguistics in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. Emily Pace has a breadth of experience across the nonprofit, public, and private sectors, including at several technology companies, the National Association of Attorneys General, the Close Up Foundation, and the Library of Congress. She was one of the leaders of Linguistics Career Launch 2021 and is now heading up Linguistics Career Launch 2024. Emily holds a BA in French and Arabic and an MS in Theoretical Linguistics, both from Georgetown University, as well as certificates from the Paris Chamber of Commerce and the Paris Institute of Political Studies. Topics discussed include computational linguistics, corpus linguistics, annotation, NLP, networking, sabbaticals, and LCL24. Links to Emily's LinkedIn profile and other resources are in the show notes. I would like to welcome to the podcast our very special guest, Emily Pace, who has been a core member of the Linguistics Career Launch Group now for 4 years. And we are going to talk partly about her journey from academia into industry, but then we're also going to talk about this year's LCL, which is happening in July. So welcome, Emily.
Thank you for having me, Laurel. I'm so excited to be here as a listener of the pod. And of course, as you mentioned, a longtime organizer for Linguistics Career Launch and for the Linguistics Beyond Academia SIG.
Why don't we start where we always start, which is talking about how you got interested in linguistics and how you found out that it was a thing that you could get a degree in?
So before I was interested in linguistics, like a lot of us, I was interested in language, right? And the first time that I ever remember kind of thinking about language critically was when I was a kid and I was watching Disney's Pocahontas. So I'm maybe like, I don't know, like 7 or 8. And there's a plot point in that movie where, of course, Pocahontas and John Smith don't speak the same language. Mm-hmm. And he's speaking English to her, and she just sort of has this confused look in her face. And then she, you know, calls on magic, listens with her heart, and now she can understand him and she speaks English. And I remember thinking at the time, like, that can't be right. And of course, you know, Disney movies. Not the thing to look to for how language works or historical accuracy, particularly with that film. But it did kind of put this spark in me of like, well, that can't be right. So there has to be a right answer somewhere about how people learn language and whatnot. So that was kind of like the first point for me. And then when I started middle school, I actually went to a middle and high school that required you to take a foreign language. Mm-hmm. So you could pick between French, Spanish, German, and Mandarin. Mm-hmm. And I picked French because it was a language that my mom had studied for a while. She worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development. And so I picked that one and really, really loved like learning the language and really loved grammar, you know, grammar being this just like little puzzle that I could figure out. And sometimes there were these rules and sometimes there were these exceptions. And so when I would take my French exams, like particularly when I was in high school, I would be sort of like highlighting all of the different parts of the sentence to be like, okay, this is what's in, you know, these are the things that are in the sentence that are cueing me into what needs to go into the blank. So now I know the answer to what goes in the blank. And then when I went to college, I went to Georgetown for my undergrad. I actually went in as a declared French major. Hmm. I wasn't really interested in teaching, which is of course what a lot of people assume when you study a foreign language. But I just thought it was a really good skill to have that would be applicable to different, like it would be an add-on to different industries or sectors that I wanted to go work into. And languages are a great way to engage with a culture as well. And so I started off on that path, but I did actually take my first linguistics course, I think in my first semester of undergrad. I didn't realize it was a linguistics course. Georgetown has their incoming freshmen take the seminar, where it's basically like professors teaching different topics of interest to them. So they change every semester. And I picked one that turned out to be a sociolinguistics class.
Wow. Okay.
I don't think sociolinguistics was anywhere in the title of the course, but I eventually came to realize that that's what the class was, and that that meant there was also this whole thing called linguistics. So after I took that, I started taking some other linguistics classes as well. So I, you know, did Intro to Linguistics, had a great time with that course. And then I actually did, despite my previously stated like lack of interest in teaching, I actually did take some courses in teaching foreign languages and teaching English as a foreign or a second language, because it just seemed like a good skill set to have, to learn more about how people learn, how different types of people learn, and that it would kind of give me a career option if I was interested in that. But I didn't, beyond taking a few courses, I wasn't a declared linguistics major in undergrad. I just continued to have this interest in the subject, and eventually would decide to pursue graduate studies in the field.
So when you were there and you were taking these classes, did you, because you mentioned sociolinguistics, did you realize who Deborah Tannen was, like, and what she'd done?
Oh,
and,
no.
Okay.
maybe by the time I was like a senior.
Uh-huh.
But definitely not right away. Did not realize that right down the hall.
Yeah.
Was this incredible figure in the field.
Yeah, Deborah Tannen, we haven't talked about her much on the podcast, but, you know, she is one of those figures who I think represents sociolinguistics to a lot of people and a certain approach. And the fact that she's a woman, right, is different, and she's at Georgetown, and she really stands for, I think, as a symbol for a lot of the sociolinguistic work that had previously, like, not even really existed. People like Robin Lakoff had been working on it, and Deborah, of course, was Robin was her mentor and did so much amazing stuff that gave people more of an easy in to linguistics proper, right? Because you can read, you just don't understand, and kind of be like, oh, I see, this is about language. And then you can figure out from there that there's a lot more about language that's not learning equations or doing really complicated stuff. It's like, this is how people communicate. And I think in the world, maybe she's not given enough credit for that, for making this kind of rigorous linguistics mm-hmm. accessible to people.
Yeah, and actually this discussion has reminded me that I definitely did know about her by the time I got to the end of my undergraduate studies, because she gave a talk at Georgetown.
Oh,
and my parents were up there, or maybe just my mom, but I invited my mom and I was like, do you want to come to this talk about women and language? And she had been an anthropology student in undergrad, and then she'd gone into to crop science. And so she'd gotten, you know, she had had her own like personal journey with the way that she was perceived as a woman in this sort of very masculine field, and then her interest in it from anthropology. And so she was like, yeah, sure. And so that was a great way to kind of expose her a little bit to like what linguistics was and that it was all around us, right? Because language mm-hmm. is everywhere.
Interesting. So what made you decide to pursue graduate studies in linguistics then?
Well, I didn't go right into it. So I actually deliberately took a break after undergrad to see what was out there, right? Mm-hmm. I kind of finished my undergraduate degree with this vague notion that maybe I would go back to school and I would study linguistics. And by that point, I did sort of have the field of computational linguistics on my radar. That'll come up again when I talk about grad school. But I didn't want to go straight through. Like, I had been a very dedicated and high achieving student, mm-hmm. but I didn't want to just say like, well, I'm good at being a student and being a student's the only thing that I know, so I'm just going to keep being a student. I thought it was important to discover other things about myself. And I did. What I figured out was that I actually really liked working 9 to 5 and then being done.
Uh-huh. Good.
And this, I graduated actually a semester early. So December of 2009, which you would probably recall would be right in the middle of the Great Recession.
Yeah.
And it was not a great landscape for getting a job. So I kind of took the first thing that was available to me, which was a contract role with a civic education nonprofit in DC called the Close Up Foundation. So they actually did, well, and I think they still do, they still exist, like educational tours of DC, which was interesting for me. At that point, I'd been living in DC for 4 years, and I got to learn through that job so much about like the specific symbolism of every single element at a given memorial. You know, like at the World War II Memorial, why are the laurels this particular leaf? Why are the states and territories in the order that they're in? Like, you know, what does each part of this symbolize? So it was a good learning experience for me. It was certainly a very demanding job, right? Like being on your feet all day. And working with high school students who have varying degrees of enthusiasm for participating in this thing that their school has signed them up for. But that ended, that was a temporary position that was only 6 months. I found it by going to like the Georgetown Career Fair, got an interview, and then they fairly quickly offered me a job after the interview. And I was just looking around being like, well, nobody's getting a job in anything, so I'm going to take this. And after that contract ended, I moved on to another organization where I would spend the next 3 years before I went to grad school. This was the National Association of Attorneys General. So if you haven't spent much time working in DC, an important thing to know is that everybody has an association. Like there's an association for everything that you could possibly want there to be an association for. And the Attorney General's Association is the association that represents all of the state and territories attorneys general.
Wow.
Right. So we have like the Attorney General of the United States as part of the Department of Justice, but then each state has their own attorney general, as do all of the US territories, right? And so the role of that organization was to facilitate a lot of training. So when you're a lawyer, which, you know, the assistant attorneys general who work in an attorney general office, they're all lawyers, right? So they require continuing legal education training. So one of the things that NAG provided was opportunities to do this CLE, continuing legal education training, in different fields that were specific to the different areas that the assistant attorneys general worked in. So, you know, you have folks who are focused on like consumer protection or bankruptcy or environmental issues. And that job gave me like a lot of exposure to what that community was like and the different things that were involved and different resources that like you have access to as a citizen, represented, you know, by your attorney general. But it also was a really, really supportive working environment. So I had the privilege of working at that organization for an executive director who made it so clear that like he was glad you were there. And it really, yeah. And it really, like my first or second day there, he came over to my cubicle and introduced himself. And he was like, tell me a little bit about yourself. Mm-hmm. And he just taught me so much about like what you should be like as a manager. And the other thing about that working environment is that so many of us who were like the administrative and event support, you know, we were all like basically fresh out of college on the track to probably go back to school at some point. A lot of people, of course, went on to go to law school. But the staff and from the executive director down were very understanding that this would be a temporary waypoint in all of our careers. And so I was very open with my bosses and the other lawyers who worked there, who I helped support, that I was planning to apply to grad school. And I got from them nothing but like, that's so great. Like, we're so happy for you. I gave more notice at that job than I've ever given notice for at anything. I told them like, I don't know, like 5 months in advance, that I was leaving to go to grad school because I didn't have any concern that they were gonna like, let me go early, right? They knew that that was how it worked, and they were mm-hmm. really supportive of that. And so mm-hmm. I just, like, I speak about this because it was so important to me to spend that time working and to have spent this really, like, early formative part of my career in an organization and with colleagues and managers who were supportive of the thing that I wanted out of life as a person.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Oh, so during this period, was there ever a time where you weren't thinking about going back to grad school? Like, was that always the end goal, or what? What did you think?
Oh, I did have a little bit of a wobble on that, because I really enjoyed the collaborations with the event manager. So one of the things that we did were these continuing legal education trainings. But there were also other receptions or gatherings that were planned primarily in the DC area, to bring the attorneys general together. I actually got to meet Joe Biden at one of these Ooh. Events. This is when he would have been vice president. So I have a photo of me and, like, the back of his head, interacting. His son Beau was the attorney general of Delaware at the time. And so I really enjoyed, like, the dynamic nature of planning those events and, you know, coordinating all of the little pieces that you would put together. So I actually did start pursuing a certificate in event management at George Washington University. Okay. I think I did all the coursework, and then I kind of stalled out on the final project when I realized that maybe that wasn't what I wanted to do. And I did, in fact, want to go to grad school.
Interesting. I will just compare and contrast that to my own experience, because I did the same thing. I took years off after my undergraduate degree, and I never really thought I was going to go to grad school. But the longer that I was toiling away in my blue collar job, I just realized that there was no future in it, and there were no jobs open to me in my area and at that time that I thought would really, like, fulfill me in any way, either financially or, you know, emotionally or spiritually. And grad school for me was the way out. Like, it represented a total change from everything that I was going through at the time. And it was just the only option that I could see for myself. And so it was it wasn't so much a decision like, I'm going to give up working and go to grad school. It was like, I need to get out of here. And grad school is going to be the way that I can get out. And I think that decision, whether you're going to go to grad school or not, is so different for everybody, right? Like, you mm-hmm. and I feel like we're at two ends of the spectrum, but it's always going to be different for people. I don't think it's hardly ever a given that you're just going to keep going from undergrad into grad school, especially now when it's so expensive and it's so fraught with danger in so many ways.
For sure. And I had kind of always had that I would go to grad school in the back of my head, and that I would probably go get a PhD. So this mm-hmm. like pursuit of this alternative event management career was really a specific response to me discovering something about myself through the mm-hmm. through the work that I had been doing. But I actually come from a two PhD family. Mm-hmm. So both of my parents have PhDs, and my dad's a lawyer. And so I was kind of like, well, I'm good at school, and I come from a household with two PhD holders. And so, like, of course I will go get a PhD. Mm-hmm. And as I was applying to grad school, I was thinking about starting to apply to grad school, and did I want to apply to PhD programs, or did I want to apply to a master's degree? And I talked to a friend of mine who was like, don't get a PhD. Mm-hmm. so he really talked me out of it, because he was really pressing me about, like, what did I think I was going to get out of doing a PhD? And I was like, well, you know, I like school and I like learning, and I think those things are great, and I could do that if I got a PhD. And he was like, he's like, don't do that. He was in a PhD program at the time. So this call was coming from inside the house. And the advice that he gave me was, that I needed to have, if I was going to go get a PhD, I should have a clear idea of what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I should know that I needed a PhD to be able to do that. And if that wasn't true, then it probably would not be a good use of my time. Mm-hmm. And I am very glad that I was talked out of that, because I think for me that ultimately wound up being the best choice to go get a master's degree and then go into the working world. But I did have to process a lot, because I had kind of had this like back of mind expectation for myself about what I would do.
I'm really glad that you told that story. And I think that's what everybody needs to consider as they're thinking about where they're going. And the old paradigm, right, was like, I'll just be in school for a while and we'll see where it goes, because there's going to be something at the end of it. And unfortunately, that is not the case anymore. Very rarely are people afforded the opportunity to just explore and see where it takes them, because there's no destination anymore. There used to be a destination, like you're going to get tenure and you're going to go have a job. And it's so rare for that to happen. And it's sad, because that's what graduate school should be for, is like exploring things and making discoveries and figuring out where your talents lie. But unfortunately, we live in late stage capitalism, and it's just not the way it can go.
We do. And I also was probably influenced at the time by what was happening with the Great Recession, right?
Yeah,
where
yeah.
you were hearing these horror stories about people who had PhDs who couldn't get like entry level jobs. And mm-hmm. so as I was being actively talked out of pursuing a PhD by a friend, you know, this other stuff within the economy of the United States was also happening, making me think like, oh, it's not necessarily a win to go do this.
Yeah. So you got into Georgetown, you did your thing. How long was the program for you at Georgetown? How many years?
So two years for the master's degree. So I went in as a terminal master's student. I went in, I think, just on the general linguistics track, but I wound up making my focus theoretical linguistics, and particularly syntax. You know, I mentioned earlier, like being a grammar nerd, and kind of no surprise that turned into being a syntax nerd, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I tried to really dabble when I was in grad school and to take classes in different fields. So I wasn't overly focused on being in the theoretical track. Mm-hmm. And I did this in a few different ways. So, you know, I took some sociolinguistics classes, including a forensic linguistics class. I didn't necessarily think that like that was a path I wanted to go, but it was just good to have a lot of different knowledge, right? And then I also tried to think about courses that would give me skills that would be applicable once I left. So I took, you know, a course in NLP. I took a course in corpus linguistics. The things that I learned in that corpus linguistics course, I wound up using like in jobs, mm-hmm. in my work following grad school. I think it might have been one of the most useful and applicable courses I've ever taken. And then particularly as I got into my second year, and I definitely knew I was, grad school had been great, but it was also really hard, and mm-hmm. I was ready to go back to work. So as I was getting into my second year, I was able to like work with my advisor a little bit to create a schedule that would accommodate both the requirements of the program and things that I wanted to learn to apply beyond academia. I was lucky to have like a supportive advisor in that regard. And he let me substitute in a course in my final semester for one of the core requirements so that I could accommodate auditing a course on non-standard annotation.
Hmm.
So this was also one of the most useful courses that I took in grad school, and it was fairly small, like five or six people, and each one of us had an assignment of a different type of sort of non-standard speech. So I was working on text messages, instant messenger, things like that. Mm-hmm. Somebody was working on like 18th century letters. Another person worked on Singlish. And it was all about like, okay, you know the guidelines, you know the Penn Tree Bank guidelines for doing annotation on news articles that are edited and written in standard American English. What do you do now that you have this different type of language? And so auditing that course, I think, was maybe the best decision that I made in all of grad school.
Mm-hmm.
Because it turns out, this is not going to be any surprise, but it turns out that in the real world, there's a lot of non-standard language.
Mm-hmm.
So having already gone through that process of, okay, how do I adapt these existing annotation guidelines to a new situation? I called on that skill again and again once I left grad school.
That's great. That is the thing that people should, if they can, if they have the bandwidth and the time and it's offered in programs, is to dabble, right? Just to take lots of things in different places to see what might jazz you or what's going to be applicable. As you were telling that story, I was just flashing on the need for people like linguists, for example, and anthropologists to be experts in non-standard varieties of English, because it is so desperately needed in areas of like jurisprudence and social work and things like that. And it reminds me of that horrible story about the poor guy who was read his Miranda rights. And because he is a non-standard speaker of English, he said something like, you know, I want a lawyer dog. And the police deliberately misinterpreted that as not invoking his right to an attorney, but saying that he wanted a dog, a literal dog. Like, talk about miscarriage of justice, yep. You know, but that stuff happens all the time.
It totally happens all the time.
And it sounds like a joke, and it's not. And, you know, like, these are the kinds of court cases. Anyway, that's what I think about that a lot. And as we always say, you need a linguist for that stuff. Like, mm-hmm. Translators, not quite there. You need to have actual linguists who are familiar with non-standard forms to explain this and maybe change the laws in some cases where people aren't being discriminated against and treated unfairly just because they don't speak standard English.
Yes, I could not agree more with all of that.
Yeah, sorry, that was my little soapbox for today. Anyway, let's get back to you.
I love a good soapbox, Laurel, anytime.
Yeah. So when you were finished with the program, Georgetown is different from most programs and provides a lot of support for when you're starting at your job search. So did you feel like you were pretty prepared to start looking for jobs after you finished your degree?
Yeah, I definitely felt fairly prepared. So I wasn't in the Masters of Language and Communication program, but their events were open to everybody in the department. So I went to all of them that I could, mm-hmm. because I knew that I would have to get a job at some point. And I really tried to like solicit advice from folks in the department, and actually got a really good, what turned out to be a great piece of advice from one of my professors, which is that I should go to the local DC NLP meetup.
Oh, okay.
So this like a meetup.com meetup for natural language processing that was in the DC area. And this was well pre-pandemic, so everything was in person. So I went to one of these events at his suggestion, and I just started networking with people and talking and wound up talking to a linguist who had graduated from University of Maryland, who asked me about what I wanted to do. And I gave the honest answer, which was like, I don't really know, something interesting. And about, I don't know, maybe 5-6 months later, as I was nearing the end of my final semester, he reached out to me to put me in contact with his boss at the time, mm-hmm. who was looking to bring on a linguist to help with this new company that was being set up as a subsidiary of his employer. And I hadn't really started much of the job search at that point, because that was the semester that I was auditing the course. Mm-hmm. So I was taking 3 required courses. I was auditing a 4th course, and I was writing my master's research paper. And I wound up needing to extend my enrollment through the summer, because I just couldn't write the paper while I was doing the coursework and trying to start thinking about the job search. And the department was able to accommodate that. So I think, mm-hmm. I paid like, you know, I had to pay some sort of summer enrollment fee that was like $1,000 or something. But it meant that I was able to move the paper to the side and then finish my coursework and spend the summer writing the paper. Mm-hmm. And so as I was in that process of writing my master's research paper and starting to think about jobs, that's when I was contacted about like, hey, do you want to talk to my boss? And so I met up with the two of them at another DCNLP meetup. And then we went out to dinner, and then I think maybe a couple weeks later, I went in for, what I thought was an interview, and it turned out to be a job offer. Not prepared for that at all. So I learned some important lessons that day. But this was with a new entity that was being set up in the U.S. called Expert System USA, a subsidiary of a company that's now called Expert AI, that was focused on trying to bring Expert AI's natural language processing technology into the U.S. government space. So federal government, you know, state and municipal government as well, but basically serving the public sector mm-hmm. in the U.S. And that ticked a lot of boxes for me, right? I wanted to stay in D.C. I am very interested in things that serve the public sector. And I was interested in going into a tech company. So we kind of moved on from there, and I was able to start working for them in August of, I think, 2015 mm-hmm. at this point. And I spent about 6 years seven years with that company, working in a variety of different roles and performing different tasks.
Yeah. So you got that job via networking. And as we always say, you know, networking is not just one thing, right? It's putting yourself out there. It's making these connections. You started it by going to a meetup and meeting people there. And that's what everybody has to do. Unfortunately, there is no you can't just be submitting your resume to sites cold, right? It helps so much if you have a personal connection to people. And I don't think we can say this enough. You know, networking is making work friends, and they don't have to be your real friends, and it's not a fake friendship. And even though it's uncomfortable sometimes, it's the way that business works. You just have to be out there and shaking people's hands and sharing little anecdotes about whatever, your pets, real estate, just to make that connection. And it will always come back to you in some way, maybe in a couple of months, maybe in a couple of years, but that's what you have to do.
Totally. And to like add a step into that. So after I met this guy, after the first meetup, I went home and I found him on LinkedIn.
Yes.
And I sent him a LinkedIn connection request saying that it was really nice to meet him mm-hmm. at the DCNLP meetup and to talk to him about these things. And I would love to connect. So when he then wanted to reach out to me later, because he thought I might be a good candidate for this open position, he had a way to do that.
Yeah.
Because I had connected with him on LinkedIn.
Yeah, exactly. So that is the way, and it's going to be that way for a while. I don't see that changing anytime soon, but it is something that everybody who's listening to this has to be comfortable with. Even if you're not actually comfortable with it, you have to get to a point where you can do it, because otherwise you're just going to feel so isolated. And this is the way business works, is that people like to help people that they know. So practice, do it early and often.
It is. And I think I want to add to the, you know, people like to help people they know. I think that's part of it. But one of the things one of the roles that I filled in my time at Expert System USA was as a manager of a team. And I'm not going to talk too much about the work that I did there. If people want to hear about that, they can go into our back catalog and listen to the mm-hmm. episode with Ezra Wishergrad. He was one of the knowledge engineers that was on the team that I led. And so he talked in more detail about that work of being a knowledge engineer. But as a hiring manager, like, I came to understand the value of networking and connections so much more, because interviewing is so hard. It's so hard to know from the hiring manager side if a person is good at interviewing mm-hmm. or if a person is going to be good at a job. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it wasn't just about like finding people in my network because I wanted to help them help a friend get this job working for me. It was like, I need to know if this person is reliable mm-hmm. and my network is the way that I can validate that.
Yeah, totally. It's like speed running the interview process. And for me too, when I had to hire for my company, you just never know. Like, people can submit resumes and they seem great, and then you meet them and you're like, nope, this person's definitely not going to work for whatever reason. You know, it might be a personality fit. It might be just their way, their style of communicating, or the way that they approach a project. And having someone that you've already met or someone that you know has met and being able to kind of grasp that stuff early on just makes it so much easier to hire people who are going to be, as you say, you know, reliable and fit the bill and will fit in the working environment that you happen to have at your job.
Totally. And sometimes it also comes down to things like these two candidates are fairly equivalent, right? And you need a way to decide between two people who probably will be equally good. Mm-hmm. And so if, you know, if both of them are somehow part of your network and one of them comes with a great recommendation and one of them comes with a less good recommendation, mm-hmm. That's a way to help make the decision. So these decisions are really hard.
Absolutely. Yeah. I hate hiring people. I'm almost as much as I hate firing people.
Oh, I love hiring people. I think it's hard, but I do love it.
Oh, I don't think I'm very good at it. Anyway, so let's, we need to talk about this summer's LCL. And I think what we've just been talking about is an actually a good transition point, because a lot of what we have tried to do is to teach these skills and to impress upon people how to do the things that we've just been talking about. Like you just gave that example about you met this guy, you reached out to him on LinkedIn so he would have your contact information, you reminded him of where you'd met and stuff. All of that is actionable advice that people don't really get. Some programs give it, but not too many of them do. And that's one of the goals of the Linguistics Career Launch, is to get that information out there to people and explain why it's important for all of the reasons that we were just talking about. Like here's how you're going to help yourself get hired.
Totally. And I think it also helps underscore that all of this stuff is work, right? You know, it's unless like a family member owns a company and is going to give you a job because you're family, you are going to have to do some amount of work to find your first job and to find subsequent jobs, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think you know, it can be fun work, right? Like networking is pretty entertaining, but it does still require like active engagement of you as the job seeker and as the career builder, and kind of framing it as like, okay, time for a new job. So I need to make sure that I've carved out time in my schedule to be able to do that.
Yep, exactly. So let's, unless there are more points you want to make about your career to this point, well, you could talk a little bit about the fact that you're sort of in a flux right now, correct?
Yes, I am in a flux. So my time at ESUSA, unfortunately, came to an end about a year and a half ago. The company was not performing to the expectation of our parent company, and so we were all kind of moved on into roles at another company, and that wound up ultimately not working out for me. For a variety of reasons. I really tried to make that new role work. That's why I was there for a year and a half. But ultimately, I decided that I needed to move on from that role, and maybe that I needed to move on from tech. And so a couple of months ago, I actually left my most recent position and started a sabbatical. That's what I'm calling it.
Good.
It's positive. It's a positive framing, right? Where I am taking some space to figure out what I want and taking some space to like frankly be happy, because I was pretty miserable.
Yeah.
Previously. And I was miserable to the point that like my husband was like, you're miserable and you're manifesting your unhappiness in a way that makes me not want to like be around you. Yeah. And it was like, okay, that's a wake up call. Like, you know, my marriage is more important to me than that job. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to focus on things that I enjoy. One of them is the LCL program for the summer that we'll be talking about in a minute. And then also just leaning into hobbies, you know, trying to do do more yoga. I'm doing a lot of baking experimentation, distributing treats to friends and friends and neighbors as part of some taste testing. But just like pursuing a lot of stuff that I like, kind of, you know, I'm sort of in a similar boat to Joseph Tyler, right?
Yeah.
Who said, like, I'm going to leave my job without another job lined up and kind of with a plan. And so that's where I am at the moment.
Yeah, I was just thinking as you were talking about that, if you haven't listened to Joe's episode, you should, because he had a similar trajectory, but his exploratory sabbatical was significant to him in a lot of ways, and it helped him kind of uplift himself into the thing that he's doing now. And plus, he's very fun to listen to. So please go listen to that if you haven't. We should also mention that you are privileged in a way to be able to do this, right? You didn't have to get another job immediately just to have a place to live and to be able to feed yourself and support your family. And that's also something that doesn't get talked about very much either. Like, you know, you have a certain amount of privilege and not everybody has that.
Totally. I feel so grateful to be in a position where I can do this, where I have a spouse who is both very supportive of this as like a personal decision for me, but also he is employed in a profession that allows us to live off of one income for the foreseeable future. Definitely not available, an option available to everybody. But we did still have to sit down and you know, do the math on it, right?
Right.
And so we'd been doing the math on this potential exit for me for like months of what would it look like. We even started a trial run like before I had decided to leave my position. We were like, okay, well, we'll just live off of his income for a couple of months and see what we think, right? So this has to be a decision that we make together. And it's you know, it's a little bit scary, right?
Yeah,
in the modern economy to be a one income household, but I do feel extremely grateful that I am in a position to be able to do this.
Yeah, that's great. So LCL, listeners to this podcast will remember that we did this in 2021 and we have decided to pull it together again for 2024. So let's talk about how it's different from the last one. It's shorter for one thing.
It is shorter. So we were, let's see, in 2021, July, I think we could say like mid-pandemic at that point.
Yeah.
So we were extremely ambitious about our 4-week program. We were so thrilled with how it turned out. I think we could call it an overwhelming success.
Yeah, absolutely.
But us as organizers also left that feeling very tired. Good tired, right? Like, I think we were all so happy that we did that. But there's a, you know, LCL 22 was much more scaled down. There was no LCL program in 2023. And so what we're doing with 2024 is really trying to finding a model for this programming that can be sustainable in the longer term, right? Because this is going, these issues of careers for linguists are going to come up every year, every time a new class graduates. And so we really want to try to find a way to make it more sustainable for us as organizers, and honestly, more sustainable for attendees as well. You know, we did get some feedback after the last program of like there were so many things, you know, that by the end of it, attendees were feeling like they needed like more space to reflect on all of the information that they were getting, and so that's obviously one big change. We have also made a lot of smaller changes to the program. And one thing that I want to underline as well is that this is not like a direct repeat of the programming that we did in 2021. So if you're a listener to the podcast or a watcher of our YouTube videos, you will know that we did a wide variety of topics in 2021. And some of them we will touch on again, particularly around career management, right? How to work on your resume, always a good workshop to have again, because people will come back to that topic needing help. But we are trying to highlight different career paths, or in some cases provide updates to what what industry sectors that were hot 3 years ago might look like now. And so things, for example, like, you know, there was a lot of hiring in user experience in 2021, like user experience and conversation design. And some of that's changed a little bit over the past 3 years, right? We haven't talked yet about kind of like the current tech layoffs that are happening and the way that Gen AI is impacting the world and particularly the business world. And so we're trying to respond to things like that. We'll have some content on generative AI as well. So we're planning different programming around there. And then we are also trying to implement just a lot of small pieces of feedback that we got from the programming last time. So we distributed a survey at the end of the 2021 program, and we've read it all. We read all the feedback and all the comments, and we're really trying to respond to that to make sure that this is a program that's valuable for people going forward.
We are also providing numerous opportunities for networking. So, yes. Because as we were just saying a minute ago, this is a crucial part of the job search and figuring out where you're going to go and what you're going to do. We want people to be comfortable in this atmosphere. So as we did before, we're using Gather, which is an online common meeting space for people to come and meet other career linguists and talk to each other too.
Yes. And actually, maybe this is a good chance for me to step back a little bit and give kind of an overview of what the program is going to look like. So if you take a look at our calendar that's on the linguisticscareerlaunch.com website, we have started to fill it in. And you can see a couple of primary divisions. So one of them is meetups, which Laurel, you were just talking about, right? So that's going to include those networking mixers and office hours and Gather. So those mixers are a great place to build connections and to just learn about all of the different things that our wonderful career linguists do. And then office hours provide people with a space to take specific questions that they might have. So, you know, maybe you want to work in a certain field and you're not sure how to take your resume and tune it to work in that field. You can go to office hours. You know, you can find somebody who works in the sector that you want to work in. You can ask them specific questions about how to improve your resume. That also, you know, can serve as a good networking opportunity as well, to continue building those connections. But we'll be offering two mixers and four office hours over the 2 weeks of the program. The other primary set of programming that we have are sessions. So we've talked about, you know, some of the content that's on our YouTube channel. Those are all good examples of the types of sessions that we will be offering as part of the LCL 24 program. So sessions will include a series of workshops and talks on career management topics taught by our very own Alex Johnson from Georgetown. Mm-hmm. So she'll be covering things like networking, making and tailoring a resume, informational interviews, using LinkedIn, and salary and benefit negotiations. We are also going to have a career management workshop from Jen Polk of PhD to Life that will cover how to leverage ChatGPT as a job search assistant, right? To help make sure that you can use it as a tool, but you're still producing good content that is reflective of you as a person and your actual skills. We'll have other workshops as well, what we're sort of calling skills workshops, that help get people an opportunity to have hands-on experience with different industries and with different skills that they might need in those industries. And so for the workshops, topics are going to include, again, Gen AI. I talked about that being a theme of the program, and like, we know it's everywhere, and we're, you know, it won't be everywhere in this program, but we are including it. Mm-hmm. So we'll have Chris Stewart, one of our co-organizers, who's currently at Google. He will be leading a two-part workshop on getting started with Gen AI applications in tech. We will also have a workshop from Anthony Koth, the lead taxonomist at Indeed, on like, what is taxonomy, right? How to build a taxonomy. We are looking to schedule a workshop on alternative careers in content creation. And we will also be offering one on computer-aided translation and localization tools. So we're going to have like a good variety, I think, of workshops that people should look at as like not just an opportunity to learn a skill for a career that they know that they want, but as an opportunity to get hands-on with something they might never have heard of, but could turn out to be of interest to them.
I was thinking as you were talking about networking, networking is like top of my mind. And one thing that I always say on this podcast is that if people are, the guests are willing to have their LinkedIn profile put on the show notes, that listeners should feel free to contact those people. And the same applies to all of the sessions that we are having. So if the people who are doing these sessions have given their contact information in their LinkedIn profile, do what Emily did and reach out to them and say, hey, I saw your session. It was really interesting. Can you give me some information about this thing? Like, there is always a way for people who are publicly available to get in touch with them and to make that connection, to make that networking connection. It's not enough to just go to the session and be like, "Ooh, that was super interesting." You got to take the next step and reach out to them so that they know who you are.
Totally. And you mentioned putting in that note of saying, "Hey, your session was great." I actually don't accept LinkedIn requests if people send them without a message of why mm-hmm. they want to connect, because yeah. I talk to so many people that it can be hard to remember, like, have I met this person or have right. I not? And it doesn't have to be anything fancy. You know, there's even like a character limit on your LinkedIn connection request
Correct.
Message,
yes.
right? So mm-hmm. you don't have to write a huge paragraph, but just saying, hey, I saw this session and it was great and I'd love to connect. Like, let's me know that you aren't just on LinkedIn trying to connect with everybody, but that like you have a reason to connect with me. Mm-hmm. Not everybody feels that way, but you as the connection requester can't know, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't necessarily know what people's personal feelings are about, like, if they want a message or not. So I think it's always good to err on the side of adding a short message to your connection request, which I think does mean that you actually have to do it from a desktop computer. The app is like a little bit more restricted about adding a message when you send a connection request. So that's just like a small logistical note that people should be keeping in mind when trying to do that.
And I will also add to that, if you're thinking about contacting someone whose session you might have attended and a little voice in your head goes, "Oh, I don't want to bother them." That's garbage. You're not bothering them. Nobody is going to think that you're bothering them if you're writing to say, "Hey, I saw your talk and it was really interesting. Can we connect on LinkedIn?" So I have said this before, and I feel very strongly that that's an academic hangover, like that you're bothering someone by getting in touch with them to say how much you enjoyed whatever, that they're just too important and they're not going to have time to talk with you. No, that's not the way it works. Not at all.
I mean, if people have a LinkedIn profile and they aren't open to connection requests, I don't really understand why they have a LinkedIn profile,
exactly.
right?
Yeah. Yep.
And you know, I think it's also important to tell people about kind of the flip side of that too, right? Which is that if somebody doesn't get back to you, don't jump back to, "Oh, it's because I bothered them."
Right.
Or,
exactly.
"Oh, it's because they don't like me." Like, you know what the answer is? It's that they're busy. They're busy with work or their personal life or anything, and they read it and they forgot to reply. You know?
Exactly. Yeah, I have done that myself, and then I have to apologize and say, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry, I was busy." But yeah, you're not bothering people. That's what networking is. I just have had so many conversations with people who don't really get what networking is. You know, that it, because it's different, right? It's a different type of social interaction than we're used to, because it's not making friends at, you know, your hobby club, the people that you, I don't know, go bowling with or whatever, or your LARP group. It's not like that. And it's not like when you're in school. It's not like anything. It's this complete other domain of making connections that I think people used to do when they went to classical networking events, like when you would belong to, I don't know, like the Rotary Club or something, right? When there were quasi business clubs that you could go to, and men did it, of course, in all of the men only clubs, like when they were Masons or Odd Fellows or Elks or whatever. That was all partially community building, but it was a lot of business stuff as well. And LinkedIn networking has now stepped in and filled that need, because it is a need. People need to do it. So you got to embrace it. You got to lean into it and make it work to your advantage.
Totally. And I think one of the segments of programming that's part of our sessions that we haven't talked about yet, but that relates to networking, is that we will also be doing career panels on a variety of topics. So this is where things like what I mentioned about, you know, like what's the current state of UX work would fit into. And these are conversations between linguists who work in the same sort of broad sector or who might work in similar roles at different companies, talking about the work that they do. So to the point that you mentioned of networking being kind of different from any sort of other social interaction, it is. But I also think that the circumstances under which you want to network with somebody can provide you an easy way to open that conversation, mm-hmm. so that it doesn't feel so difficult. So, you know, if you go to a career panel during LCL from a sector that you don't know a lot about, reach out to somebody and you want to learn more, right? You think like, oh, this is cool and maybe I could do this. You know, you reach out to one of the panelists to connect with them on LinkedIn, saying that you saw their panel, you know, on this topic at this event, and you would love to connect with them. And then if they accept your request, follow up with them again and say, hey, you know, could I set up a time with you to do like a 15-minute informational interview and learn more about your specific role? Or I have some questions about your specific industry. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great way to like very easily build on something that you know they're already interested in talking about, right? Because they came to LCL and they talked about it. And hopefully that can, for some people, you know, help remove like the awkwardness or the feeling of being a burden in this networking connection.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. That's the way to do it. Let's shift real quick to some of the tactical information. So Linguistics Career Launch, that's the website, linguisticscareerlaunch.com, all one word. It's happening in July. So July 15th through the 26th of 2024. It's 2 weeks.
Weekdays only. So don't worry, we're not taking your weekend away.
Yep. There's a calendar on the website, as Emily mentioned, which is in progress because we're still adding stuff. It probably won't be finalized for like another month. We're recording this right at the end of May. So stuff keeps happening and we're lining people up. There's an FAQ that gives you all of the information you need to know about how to attend. Registration is now open. So you can go there and buy a ticket through Eventbrite. Just a word about the money that you have to pay to attend. You know, we'd love to give this away for free. We'd like that more than anything, but we can't. There are costs involved in it, but the cost that you would pay to go to this thing for 2 weeks is so far below what any other professional development fee would be for equivalent programming. Like sometimes people complain and then you got to look around at what you'd pay for something, say through LinkedIn, for example, and professional development courses that don't have nearly as much programming for this are thousands and thousands of dollars. So the value for money spent is actually tremendous. I will say that.
It is. And I want to highlight a couple of things about some of the ticketing options that we have available this year. So we really love it when departments fund students to come to our program. It benefits the students because it helps, you know, offset the cost to them. And it benefits departments because it's a way for them to provide this professional development education in a very cost efficient way. And, you know, they don't have to organize or plan the programming. And so this year, one of the things that we are offering is a group ticket for four people to attend the general registration. So general registration includes everything that we've talked about so far, all of your sessions, all of your meetups, and it gives you, in buying this group ticket, you get over $100 off the price of four tickets. We are also open, if your department wants to send more than four people, we are also open to discussing additional discounts. So if you are in that group of people, you know, maybe you've got 6, 8, even 10 people from your department who want to come, send us an email at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com. And we are happy to talk to you about accommodating a larger group ticket.
And what is the early bird registration price?
Yes. So early bird registration is $215 per person. That is inclusive of all of the fees from Eventbrite. And that will be available through June 24th. On June 25th, the regular general registration pricing will start, and that will be $295 per person. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in coming, signing up for early bird is a great way to save $80 on the cost of your registration for the program.
Yeah. And we are very transparent about where the money goes. We are also, you'll see if you go to the website looking for sponsorship, what we're doing is paying for our costs of doing it because we have to have website hosting and all those things. But we are trying to pay people for their time. So we're trying to pay the panelists who come, the other folks who are doing the work. We have some interns who are helping out with all of the back-end admin that goes with it. So we're not making money off of this. We are spending it all on making this a really good program.
Definitely. I've done a couple hundred hours of work so far in exchange for kudos. So it's definitely not a profit driven enterprise, but we do want to make sure that it can be sustainable.
Yeah.
And part of making it sustainable is not indefinitely relying on, mm-hmm. on free labor. Yeah. So I'm glad that you brought those points up. One thing that I do want to talk about as we start to get to the end here is one other offering that's on the table for this year's program, which is courses. Mm-hmm. So we offered a couple of courses in 2021 that proved to be extremely popular and valuable for folks. We are offering different courses this year, right? So to the tune of not wanting to like repeat the exact same programming that we've done in the past, we are offering two different courses. Courses are an add-on to general registration. So if you are interested in taking a course, you will need to register for general registration and register for a course on top of that. So we actually have separate tickets set up if you just want general registration, or if you want general registration plus a course. The two courses that we're offering this year, one is in document design with our LCL organizer, Nancy Frischberg. She is a fascinating person who, speaking of dabbling, has dabbled in many things. And one of the things that she does right now is owns and operates an olive oil farm in Northern California. So the document design course is going to focus on revising some of the certification materials that the California Olive Oil Council uses, because Nancy has looked at some of these materials, as a linguist and as a producer mm-hmm. of olive oil, and said, man, this document is 17 pages and it could be 4 pages. And how do we make that happen so that it's better for everybody, right? It's better for the people who have to use the document as producers and vendors. It's better for the council, who would have to like provide less support if the form could be improved in this way, less staff support, I mean. And so she will be using this real life example and having the class work through how to revamp the document in various rounds of design and user testing. So that's the document design course. The second course that we're offering is with Anna Marie Truster, longtime friend of Linguistics Beyond Academia, actually one of the founders of the mm-hmm. Linguistics Beyond Academia SIG. And she will be offering a course in career discernment. This course is actually another thing that is a response to some of the feedback that we got in the 2021 program. We heard from folks who needed more individual support and sort of more of a like small group environment where they could be working on things together in response to the programming that we were doing at LCL. And so that's what Anna Marie is going to be presenting through career discernment. So this is a course that, despite what the name might make you think, is not a duplicate of the main programming of LCL. It truly is an add-on that is designed for folks who, want to go to like Alex's workshop on resumes and then go sit down with a group of peers and start, revising their resume and reading other people's revisions. and giving feedback and things like that. And so we think this course is going to be a really great add-on to the overall offering that we have. Both of the courses cost the same amount of money, and they're the same length of time. So they're both 11 contact hours. The specific times for the course are on the website. We have some information about courses, so you can go there to look at the times that the courses will be taking place. And the early bird general registration plus a course is $455.
And to be clear, you don't have to take a course if you don't want to.
Totally.
You can do all the other stuff and not take courses.
Yeah, you can just do general registration. So we have that separate ticket for that. That's $215. Or you can do general registration plus one of the two courses that I mentioned for $455. And we welcome people to either.
Yeah. Whatever is going to work for you, you should feel free to do it. There is going to be a limit on the courses. So they're not going to be, you know, hundreds of people in each one. We want to keep it to a place where you are having direct contact with your instructor and everybody gets some time to do things.
Yes, the courses are capped at 30 people. And we did sell out the courses last time, and we had a wait list for the courses. So definitely, if that's something that interests you, I would recommend, you know, signing up for a course sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. But if you have any questions about how to pick between the courses, because the courses are happening at the same time, so you can only pick one. Mm-hmm. And if you are concerned about which course you should pick, which one might be the best fit for you, again, you're welcome to reach out to us at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com. And we are happy to help you evaluate what might be the best choice for you.
Yeah. You can go on to the YouTube channel and see all the content that we had from the last time. There are going to be a couple of sessions that won't be recorded that are on more, let's say, sensitive topics where people can express themselves a little more honestly, perhaps. You know, there's always stuff that comes up that is good to talk about, but we don't necessarily want to put it out there for the world to see, around topics like, yeah, should I get a PhD, for example?
Which you and I are going to talk about, because we have thoughts about that.
We have talked about it. And there's always personal stuff that comes up that folks might not feel very comfortable putting out there in public. But you can rest assured that anything that's not being recorded, it will always be kept confidential. And you can share anything you want to, as long as you feel like speaking up. So in some of the discussion sessions, people can turn on their mics, they can turn on their cameras so that they can talk, or you can also comment or ask questions in the chat as well. So there's different ways that you can participate in any of the sessions that we're going to have.
And actually talking about some of this recording, there is one more thing that I want to add to the end of our LCL discussion. So we've talked about why this program costs money, right? We are trying to keep it as affordable as we can, but we do recognize that, you know, any amount of money might be a price point that's too high for some people. And so one of the things that is really important to us is that the sessions that we record, so the Zoom sessions that we do on career management and career panels and the workshops, we make those available on YouTube for free in the months following LCL. So we'll probably start getting those up over the fall. But we want to provide high quality content. So that means edited videos. And that also means captions, right?
Yes.
And both of those things cost money. So I do want to put out a very humble request to anybody who is a listener to the podcast. If you like this content, the podcast, if you like our YouTube videos, consider going into Eventbrite and providing us with a donation. There is a donation ticket in Eventbrite. You can donate any amount, even if it's $5. We are so happy to have that to help make sure that not only can Linguistics Career Launch 24 be a success in July while it's happening, but that we can make sure that we are providing this high quality content for people for free over the fall and winter when we're releasing these videos.
Yep. And also, as we did before, if you're a listener to the podcast, we took the audio from the recorded sessions and then we turned them into podcast episodes as well, because people like to consume content in different ways. Some folks don't mind sitting at the computer with their phone and watching a video, but some folks prefer to have the audio only. And frankly, most of the sessions work pretty well without any visuals, and you can just follow what folks are saying. So all of the content that we record that will be in YouTube videos will also be eventually put out on the podcast as separate episodes.
Yes. And donations that people make would also go towards helping to continue to fund the podcast as well. So we would love for folks to consider that option, and we would be very grateful for any amount of support that people can provide.
Yeah. So I think that's all about LCL. We covered all of the main points that are happening. As we mentioned before, the calendar is being updated constantly, so go have a look at it. We'll put up a note when everything is locked down finally, but it will be changing as people's schedules change and we're able to add new things. We're even now coming up with new ideas for panels.
And we are actively, like, we are in it about panel scheduling, right? So there's a lot of coordination to find times that you know, work for everybody who's going to be on a given panel, and then to get that on the calendar. So if you're looking at the calendar and you're not seeing a topic that you were maybe thinking that we would cover, like, check back in a few days. We are, yeah. You know, and just keep checking it regularly, because, like you said, Laurel, like, we are very actively working on planning the program, getting things scheduled, and updating the calendar.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I think that will about wrap it up. I assume it's okay to put your LinkedIn link on the show notes to this. Is that correct?
It is, but put in a note about why you want to connect with me. just, you know, that you listen to the podcast or you've seen something I've done on one of the LCL videos and you'd like to connect.
Yeah. And if you're listening to this and you like the podcast and you like the idea of the LCL, but maybe you're not sure if you can do it, you can get on our mailing list also. There's a contact form you can fill out. And if you just want to get emails from us about all the stuff we're doing, you can do that too. There might be something in the future that appeals to you.
Totally. And again, you know, if people have any questions about the program, like, email us at linguisticscareerlaunch.com, or not linguisticscareerlaunch.com, linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.
Yes.
And I'm actually the one who answers those emails at the moment. So that's another way for people to contact me, particularly if they have any questions about the program. Yeah.
Well, Emily, thank you so much for spending this time talking about your own journey and then outlining the LCL for everybody. And I'm sure that people will be contacting you after this.
I hope so. We're looking forward to another great program this year. And I'm really excited to see the changes that we will be able to bring to people's conception of their own career. You know, we know that the LCL 21 program and LCL 22 were just so impactful for people's job searches. And we're really looking forward to that again this year.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the basic terms, people got jobs because of LCL 21.
Totally.
They really did. Lots of people got jobs because of it. And some of those people have been on the podcast and talked about it. So it's not a guarantee, but it will really increase your chances of getting a job.
Totally.
Linguistics Career Launch 2021 was a one-month intensive program intended to familiarize linguistics students and faculty with career options beyond academia in business, tech, government, and nonprofit organizations. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. LCL 2021 was organized by Nancy Frischberg, Alexander Johnston, Emily Pace, Susan Steele, and Laurel Sutton. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.